investment used to mean creating a better future. Mm-hmm. But now it sort of means creating more money in the future, almost at the expense of the future. So it's really about changing the whole mindset of why we're investing and what we're hoping to receive from that investment.
Welcome to The Greener Way, the show about people, planet, and purpose, and how investors and corporate leaders push forward in a complex world. My name is Rose Mary Petrus, Senior Journalist at FS Sustainability. Today, we're going to talk about degrowth and post-growth economics, regenerative and sustainable systems, and social tipping points with Erin Remblance, founder of Rebiz. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Erin, you're so, so busy with all your projects. You're working as a founder and as a writer. And so thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and share your insights today. So we don't miss anything, let's start off with your background, your current projects, and what inspired you to get involved with this space?
Yeah, so I studied business outside when I finished school. I did a business degree. I worked in fast-moving consumer goods for a decade, and then I had my family and I was working part-time, but just had a little bit more space to start reading more and learning more about what was happening in the world. And I'd had my youngest, it was just over 5 years ago, and actually someone had sent me the article. It was after the release of the IPCC report into special report into 1.5 degrees of warming. And I was just reading it as I was putting my youngest to sleep. I was walking around with her on me. And the title was, the UN says climate genocide is coming. Actually, it's worse than that. And I really just couldn't stop my heart racing. I couldn't stop thinking, this is not okay. I should be doing more. So that probably was the platform, the jumping board, I guess, diving board into my climate activism. And I sort of haven't really stopped since then. I've just, I think my husband was waiting for it to like ease off, and I've just become more and more active. Because the more you learn, the more you realize that actually this is a lot worse than a lot of people realize. That's sort of why I do what I do. In the process, I've realized it's not just climate, that there's a whole myriad of ecological crises, that technology is not the solution. We're going to need to do a lot more than just switch out coal-fired power for renewables and electric vehicles for internal combustion engines. And so I've just been trying to immerse myself in some of that knowledge.
Can you give us a little intro into the different projects and businesses that you're working on?
Yeah, so we started Rebiz last year, last January, and that's a four-week program or course just taking people through the individual, so like mindset and worldview changes, the organizational and the systemic changes that we need to see happen if we're going to reach true sustainability, true regeneration. And so that's a really wonderful course to be a part of. We've run it maybe 10 times now, and I enjoy it every time. The people you meet are really amazing, and watching them really start to understand the true nature of our crises is, you know, it feels very powerful. We also started Project Tipping Point this January, which is, I sort of finished the Rebiz course going like, this is a lot. I get it. This is a lot. But the way we can move forward to where we need to be is through social tipping points. And Project Tipping Point is about how we can engineer a social tipping point when it comes to creating an economy that has people and the planet at the heart of it, not simply profit and growth. And so we're in the middle of the second cohort now. We've had just over 200 people come through, and that's really amazing too, because it's global. We run three different sort of face-to-face or Zoom workshops each week so that we can match a few different time zones. And that's really a fun experience too, like just feeling like we're being part of the change that we need to see is really where my heart is. So I enjoy the work a lot.
And what kind of members do you have? Is it mostly people from the public sector or the private sector?
Yeah, it's both. Yeah, we have both. I'd say it's people who get it, who really understand that we're not moving fast enough, quickly enough, and want to be a part of the positive changes that we need to see. So you're not seeing, you know, your regular, you know, person on the street coming in to join Project Tipping Point. These people will probably work in sustainability or in policy or have their own businesses that they're trying to make regenerative. But yeah, it's like lots of different people, lots of different age groups. There's a good mix of male and female. There's a mix of global south versus global north. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really for anyone who wants to be a part of the change and help us reach the social tipping point, I guess.
So what is the idea of degrowth and post-growth economics?
Degrowth is recognition that we're living as if we have 1.7 planet Earths. And that, you know, eventually your debt comes due. So, you know, it might not feel like that is a problem for us now, but there's only so long you can do that before we start to see, you know, we're not being able to produce enough food, or, you know, the temperature warms so much that it becomes, you know, large parts of the planet become uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. So I define degrowth in two ways. The first is a planned and democratic reduction in material and energy throughput, so that we're aligning with the science around planetary boundaries mm-hmm. in a way that improves social well-being and global justice. So, you know, there's lots in there, but I think we need to recognize that it's planned as opposed to collapse. And really, that's where what we're facing at the moment. This is not choosing between business as usual and, you know, a degrowth future. We're choosing between collapse and, mm-hmm. you know, the potential of a degrowth, a planned reduction in production and consumption. Mm-hmm. Democratic, so we're not talking authoritarian. We're not going to make people do things. It should be decided in a democratic process about which industries we reduce. Reduction of material and energy throughput. So that's really what's causing a lot of our ecological crises. You know, biodiversity loss, ocean acidification, it's all caused by how much energy we're using. So back in line with the planetary boundaries, we're breaching 6 of 9 planetary boundaries already. And climate change is just one of those. So there's 5 other planetary boundaries that we don't hear enough about. So focusing on all of those planetary boundaries, not having carbon tunnel vision, which is what can sometimes happen in this space. And then in a way that improves social well-being. So, you know, it doesn't, using fewer energies and energy and materials doesn't have to be a horrible experience. One of the first things you hear when you talk about degrowth is that you must hate poor people, because, you know, essentially one of the myths we've been told is that you need economic growth to alleviate poverty. And it's simply not based in any of the data. You know, globally, poverty still exists in virtually the same numbers, even though we've been trying to fight it for 4 decades through economic growth or longer. And, you know, in terms of global justice, it's very hard for countries in the global south to increase their material and energy throughput while countries in the global north are shooting through all the ecological barriers. You know, mm-hmm. we're just not creating any space for them to do that without reaching global collapse. So, for example, Australia reached Earth Overshoot Day on Friday, the 5th of April, mm-hmm. which means we're living as if we have 4 planet Earths. You know, the Australian lifestyle is really unsustainable. So if we can contract what we're using, then we free up space so that other countries can use more. Whilst without exceeding planetary boundaries. So that's the first definition. I'll quickly go through the second one, which is just a decolonization of the imaginary and an implementation of other possible worlds. And it's just, so in this instance, D, so in the first definition, D means down, so a reduction. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, the second definition, D means away from. And it's just moving away from economic growth as being the solution to all our ills. You know, if people need housing, provide them with housing. If people need food, make sure they have food. You know, don't mm-hmm. wait for the economy to grow to be able to do these things. We can just do these things.
And as you know, a lot of our listeners are in the finance industry or the business world. How do you envision finance professionals, particularly, integrating these concepts of regenerative systems, degrowth, and social tipping points into their frameworks?
Yeah, look, it's a really tricky place to be if you're in finance and you can understand the rationale behind a post-growth mm-hmm. future. I really, and maybe your listeners know more than me, but I feel like the finance world is predicated on, you know, constant growth. This idea mm-hmm. that we invest our superannuation so that it grows and compound interest. And the flip side to this, you know, the huge benefit that I understand about compound interest is that all of that interest comes at a price, and that's the, you know, the devastation of the natural world and really mm-hmm. some of the human populations that go into that growth as well. So, what does it mean? So I think it's very untenable to continue to have a small portion of the population increasing their wealth in an economy that's contracting. Like, I don't think that would work. So it really means the end of growth, even for finance professionals. Certainly there'd be space for investing if you're an impact investor and you're wanting to just do it because it makes sense. And there's a post-growth economist in the UK, his name's Tim Jackson. He's written a lot about post-growth, and he would describe the way that people invest has changed over time. So people used to invest, for example, in, you know, a public park because that would bring joy to the local population. So basically investment used to mean creating a better future. But now it sort of means creating more money in the future, almost at the expense of the future. So it's really about changing the whole mindset of why we're investing and what we're hoping to receive from that investment. I don't know, this didn't come up in your questions. I hope you don't mind if I just throw it in, but I think there needs to be some people engaging with the concept of modern monetary theory as well, where the state or a currency issuing nation has the ability to create as much money as it wants to. So we don't necessarily need people's money to achieve anything that needs to be achieved. Like, if we had the democratic will to roll out renewables as quickly as possible, to provide everyone with universal public services, to do all of these things, Australia as a currency issuing nation can simply do those things. Obviously, you need to worry about inflation and the real resources you have in the economy, real resources being, do you have enough nurses? Do you have enough teachers? Do you have enough capacity to produce solar? Like, these are the real resources, but money itself is not a problem and not a scarce resource.
When it comes to climate action, what is a social tipping point?
So social tipping points a bit. So maybe your listeners are aware of tipping points in the climate system. So for example, we're at the point now where the Amazon rainforest could maybe likely to tip into a savanna in the future. So instead of drawing down carbon, it's going to release a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. And once that happens, we can't turn it back into a rainforest really within, you know, what we consider a reasonable time frame. Same with the Arctic, the Arctic, we've lost the Arctic. So it hasn't happened yet, but we know that in the next decade, probably maybe early 2030s, there'll be a blue ocean event because that will have an ice-free Arctic Ocean, and that creates a feedback loop because the blue waters of an ice-free ocean absorb more heat than the reflective white ice of an ice-covered ocean, and so that's a tipping point too. But we've lost that one, and there's about 15 different tipping points. So anyway, so these exist, and we know they exist, and they're not really adequately covered in the IPCC modelling, but there's also social tipping points. And we've seen them happen, you know, a dozen times in the last century. It's, you know, when women won the right to vote, they had to push. There was lots of different ways they were doing it. They were protesting. There was, you know, often violent civil disobedience, not just non-violent civil disobedience. And then once they got the right to vote, it happened very quickly, you know, like, so you reach that critical mass, you change enough opinions, and actually people have a natural tendency to want to side with the status quo. So if you can move enough people, and they, you know, some social sciences say that it's about 25%, then people start to realize that the status quo is changing and they want to side with the status quo. And now they're, you know, in the example of women's right to vote, now they're pro women gaining the right to vote, or it might be marriage equality, or it might be Black Lives Matter, or the Arab Spring, all of these different occasions where push, and then eventually it just happens almost on a dime. Very quickly, attitudes can change. So we go through that in our project Tipping Point about what you can do that will help create a social tipping point. Because there's a lot of things that are important. Like, you need to incubate the first movers so that they feel safe enough to continue on that path and not slip back into their old habits because they feel lonely or lost or like a social outcast, you know. And then, you know, it's about creating wide bridges and using the periphery rather than influence. So there's a lot of science that goes behind it. And we reference the work of Damon Santola a lot, and from his book, Change, How to Make Big Things Happen. And lots, you know, probably a dozen other people that we reference as well. But yeah, just acknowledging that everything is not lost, that most people want a habitable planet. We just need to know how to go about it and just trying to create some momentum in that direction.
Yeah. And you place a strong emphasis on partnerships with First Nations organizations. So how do you collaborate with these communities, and what lessons have been learned in this space?
Yeah, so part of our revenue, about 10% of our revenue goes to whichever First Nations project that we decide. So we work with a different couple of different ones. And my co-founder, Ryan, he works with The Fountain, which is an Indigenous community group in the US. And he has a lot of elders that he works with directly. I tend to be the post-growth, you know, not, I wouldn't say expert's the right word necessarily, but that's where my interests lie. And he's more of the Indigenous cultures. So he has that network that he works in The Fountain enterprise as well. And yeah, he just has those strong connections and picks up lots of learnings through his connections and shares some of that wisdom with our Rebiz members.
Yeah. And so the idea of decomposing the existing system suggests a really radical departure from conventional business practices. What do you see this looking like? And also, how do you envision the role of the public and private sectors evolving in this transition?
Yeah. So like really when it comes down to it, to achieve what we need to achieve, what the science says we need to do, the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, the contraction so that we're back within planetary boundaries, we need to change the system. Like it's not possible for us to continue to grow our economy and for everything to be fine. Like this, there's an idea of decoupling growth from environmental harm, and it just hasn't happened. It hasn't happened globally, which is where it needs to happen. There's pockets of it happening, but even in the pockets where it has been happening, it's not happening at a pace and scale fast enough to avoid, you know, reaching 2 degrees of warming and these sorts of things.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that indicates that we need to change the system. And so, and that's what we mean by decomposing. For me, the work will come from citizens acting like citizens. I don't personally believe that businesses can lead the change. Certainly you can if you're not beholden to the growth imperative. Then it's your business and you can do what you want and you can make your products as sustainable as you need to do. But then, you know, I just keep coming back to the idea that there's no such thing as a sustainable business in an unsustainable system. So even if your business is now very sustainable, you still exist in an unsustainable system. And I think it will be citizens working as citizens, trying to create more democracy, trying to educate, trying to push, trying to reach social tipping points that will bring about that systemic change. And, you know, it'll take a lot. It might, you know, it may indeed take deprivatizing organizations so that we can start to reduce them and, you know, providing citizens with a job guarantee and reducing the work week to 3 to 4 days. These are some of the things that we could do if we got serious about reducing our emissions in a way that improves social well-being.
Today, we've been hearing about degrowth and post-growth economics, regenerative and sustainable systems, and social tipping points with Erin Remblance, founder of Rebiz. Erin, where can people connect with you and find your programs?
So I'm most active on LinkedIn. So yeah, definitely reach out on LinkedIn if you're on there. I'm also on Twitter, but a little bit less active there. And our website's www.rebiz.io. So if you want to learn more about either our flagship course or Project Tipping Point, that's where you can find more information.
Great. Erin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
The Green Away podcast is a product of FS Sustainability, a show about people, the planet, and investing in our collective future. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. The Green Away podcast gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by discussing numerous financial sustainable options and our featured guests. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of The Greener Way are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.